Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Resident Evil Welcome to Raccoon City, which after six, count them, six.
Is that all?
Paul W.S. Anderson, Mila Jovovich, Resident Evil films, junks that continuity and attempts to hew a lot closer to the video game IP. Matt can and will speak more directly to this movie's fidelity to that IP. I have not played the Resident Evil games myself for the most part, so yeah, I'm a little less well-versed.
I'm no RE purist by any means. There's several of the latter-day games that I've yet to get around to, but I'm very fond of some of them. The GameCube remake of the first Resident Evil is among my personal faves, you know, certainly when it comes to survival horror, but just games in general. It's really, really excellent.
The film was directed by Johannes Roberts, who is perilously close in my mind to joining the Jeff Wadlow, Adam Robitel, William Brent Bell tier of schlockmongers.
Right, so what is he responsible for? He did Strangers Prey at Night. He did 47 Meters Down, right?
Yeah, he did the sequel to 47 Meters Down.
Uncaged, which I don't think I've seen.
I haven't seen that either because I loathed the original.
Well, I remember because the sequel came out. It would have been part of our podcast purview, and you just...
I said no.
Completely, yeah.
I drew the line. No, Matt. We're not... I just loathe that first movie, and I'm not going to get into it at length. I haven't watched any of his other movies, although I've scrolled through his filmography, and the further back you get, the like more obscure and low budget you get.
Uh-huh.
There's a film from 2001 on there called Sanitarium. Looks like it was made for about $40.
Right.
It's got a 2.8 on IMDb, which is very difficult to do.
I was telling you before we started recording, I always get him mixed up with the guy who directed Orphan, who I also don't particularly care for. So their filmographies are just kind of a T-virus style.
Amalgam.
Stitched up, yeah, fused together abomination.
Just to put it right out there now, I didn't really like this movie very much, but I think it might still be my favorite of his films.
I would sign off on that. There's one sequence. Strangers Prey at Night is dreadful, but there's one sequence in it. He puts a lot of like classic rock needle drops in his movies, and they basically never work for me. The one exception is there's a brawl in and around a pool, like a motel pool in Strangers Prey at Night, set to Total Eclipse of the Heart.
Yeah.
That kind of got me, I think we were alone in the theater when we saw that.
I believe so.
And I was like moving and grooving that whole scene. It's easily the apex of his career. And then there's another one in that same movie, not 20 minutes later. I think the climax is cut to an Air Supply song, and that was like a complete dud. So like, I don't know what happened. I don't know how you have it and then you lose it that quickly, but...
When you have it by accident, that's how.
I guess.
It just took a shot in the dark and hit the fucking bullseye with Bonnie Tyler, and then didn't even hit the dartboard with the rest of the shots.
Yeah, and Welcome to Raccoon City has its own fair share of dad rock needle drops, none of which did anything for me.
Yeah, not a one. Anyway, why don't you take it away?
We open in, wouldn't you know it, Raccoon City. In an orphanage, requisite spooky horror movie orphanage. Opening shots are kind of strange. The music, which generally through this movie is rather good. I think the music is definitely the standout feature. But the opening, the titles are just... Maybe it's just because we've had a half dozen Paul W.S. Anderson Resident Evil movies, but the opening shots of this one struck me as kind of pompous. the font, the titles... The music is this like Rosemary's Baby sinister lullaby kind of thing. Like, and it's like, what? And there's little vestiges of that all through the movie. It'll be like 1:23 a.m., 2:29 a.m. It's like, what is this? The Shining? You know, Wednesday.
There's that, but it reminded me of nothing quite so much as playing a Dead Rising game.
Sure.
Where it's just like 47 hours remain.
Uh-huh.
there's a ticking clock. And I was pretty sure that wasn't a feature of the Resident Evil games.
No, in those games, you have as much time as you need.
Right.
Although, in a mechanical sense, I mean, the narrative, like most video games, everything is just on pause until you hit the next trigger, no matter how urgent things seem.
Like the video of the guy playing Heavy Rain and tripping over everything.
Yes.
This is not the first time we've brought this up.
Admittedly, an extreme example and an extremely funny one.
Yeah. But anyway, we find out not too far into the movie, if we didn't already know from the games, that Umbrella's going to blow up the town at 6 a.m. So,
well, and those, only because I don't trust myself to bring it up later on, those Shining style timestamps. First of all, I like the way they're used in The Shining because they're so erratic. It starts out as like the interview. And then Thursday, the increments of time get smaller and smaller until it's counting down hours. So there is an escalation in that sense, but mainly it's just a little bit chaotic. Here, it's equally chaotic in that like midnight and 1 a.m. are like 2 minutes apart. If memory serves, they're like real close together.
Yeah.
And nothing of consequence happens between them. And we like skip right over 5 a.m. We never get a 5 a.m. And then it gets right to 5:55, you know, like right before the bombs are about to fall. It's just...
Well, and then somebody says like, oh, it cuts off, which is stupid because this
movie
is not right.
No, it's full of F-bombs.
Yeah, this movie is not like rated PG-13 and they had to censor themselves. It's chock full of F-bombs. And then we see the mansion just like kind of collapsing. It doesn't
blow
up. It
was so weird. It's like they set off subterranean explosives, which makes an amount of sense, but they didn't. It sure seemed like the town was otherwise being shelled. So that it was very strange.
It looked
strange.
Magical.
Yes, it did. It looked like a big hand was going to come out. It was like a portal to another dimension was swallowing the Spencer Mansion whole.
So, okay, they're going to blow up the town at 6 a.m. That starts happening. But then there's like a 3 or 4 minute boss fight. And then the bombs go off in the rest of the town. It's weirdly staggered.
Yeah, it is. It comes in two waves. And the second wave is like something out of Twister from 1996.
Well, there's like a kind of stupid cow gang.
Yeah, this like shoddy looking CGI cow in the foreground that gets like blown off screen. Primo like 90s cheese. This movie is in fact, I think, supposed to be set in the 90s.
Well, yeah, it's just like, well, the games came out in the 90s. I guess the fucking movie has to be set in the 90s. Anyway, we're getting way ahead of ourselves.
Point being, the 1 a.m., 2 a.m., all that stuff, that sort of carries the torch of this strange art house horror pretentiousness of these opening shots where it looks like you're watching, you know, fucking The Exorcist or something with the typography and the choice of music and this camera slowly drifting down this dark hallway. And then we move into Johannes country, Johannesburg, very quickly.
Joburg.
Yeah. We're introduced to two little orphans, one of whom is being poked and prodded in her sleep by a kind of grimy, corpsey looking hand. And she wakes up, tells her brother, "It happened again. She was here. I saw her." "No, go back to sleep." She, the little girl, goes looking around this big, spooky orphanage and finds a tent on an upper floor with a bog witch inside of it. Name of Lisa Trevor, and she introduces herself. She's mostly nonverbal, but she's got like a tag, like a patient wristband.
Yeah, hospital wristband.
"Where do you live?" And then she scrawls the word "below" in, you know, a black crayon, of course, very straggly, scary looking handwriting. And then the girl gets jump scared by a doctor. "What are you doing out of bed, little girl?" And then he refers to her and her brother by name very inelegantly, which is another torch that the movie carries all the way through to the end. Indeed, a little bit after the end.
Redfield, right? Chris and Claire?
Chris and Claire Redfield. It's like, as if that means anything.
It's like that.
Shouldn't mean anything to him.
Right. Well, it's like that fucking gag from Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, where they're doing Good Will Hunting 2 hunting season. That line of dialogue, like, "You think you're pretty good, Will Hunting?" It's like these asinine fucking would-be offhanded name drops.
Well, it's like probably the nadir of Dark Knight Rises is the random receptionist lady going, "I like that name, Robin." But that happens in this movie like 15 times.
Yeah, we'll get to more of them in very short order. But I was saying to Matt as we were walking out of the theater, if they're going to shoehorn these names in this aggressively, if they're not going to like drip feed them more casually with like first names and only every once in a while, then they should just have text. Just like, you know, like,
right.
Typing out the text.
That feels like the Roland Emmerich thing to do. Like, Godzilla was full of that.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're leaning into the 90s cheese, that would have probably been the way to go. It's also gamey.
Yeah, you know, it's video gamey. So I wouldn't have minded. But no. This was just dreadful.
Well, I countered, again, this was before we started recording, these name drops are obviously for the fans because, you know, Chris and Claire Redfield is going to mean nothing to Joe Schmo, who bought a movie ticket because this is the horror movie that's playing this week at the local movie house. You know, if you haven't played the games or I guess seen the other movies or watched like a fucking Let's Play or something or read some fan fiction, then these names are, you know, it's all Greek to you.
I don't think the Redfields actually turn up in the other movies.
Well, yeah, because Paul W.S. is making room for his fan fiction OC.
They might later. I can't fucking remember. It's such a crapshoot. Like, none of the characters, like, whatever their names are, they don't really matter, particularly in, like, the second half of that sextilogy. You know? It's just like, yes. Oh, that happens to be nominally this character from the video games. But yeah. It's really just like, oh, it's Jill Valentine and two, and then the rest of them are just whatever.
Full disclosure, I have not seen the Resident Evil sextet. I've not seen a one of them. They're on my to-do list.
I'll subject you to them eventually.
Yeah. Can't wait. So they're sent back to bed, the twins. They're not twins, they're brother and sister, Chris and Claire Redfield. And Claire looks down at the foot of her bed and Lisa, who just scurries around like a spider monkey, like on the ceilings much of the time, has left a doll, creepy looking, black-eyed little plaything on her bed. And then we cut to present day. I figured we would get a title drop here. Title drop is delayed. It comes at a very strange, sort of arbitrary juncture in a few minutes. We meet... Okay. Here's why they don't. Because...
They need to use a road sign.
Well, and they need to do the "it was only a dream" thing, but it's very half-hearted and kind of perfunctory. So Claire, for whatever, it's pitched so strangely. Claire has not been afraid of Lisa at all up until this point. She just wants to be friends. But for some reason, seeing this doll makes little Claire go like, and then adult Claire wakes up in the passenger seat of this truck and goes like, And it's actually quieter than that. I oversold it a little bit. And then the truck driver, who we intuit immediately, she doesn't know. She's just hitchhiking, I guess. He says, "If I'd known you were going to scream yourself awake, I would have left you by the side of the road. Almost,
I would have blown my brains out.
Almost made me shit myself." It's like, she barely tittered. Maybe you're about to shit yourself at all times, at the slightest provocation, because you're eating the world's grossest, greasiest cheeseburger.
She makes these awful squelching noises.
Yes, it's terrible.
Horrifying Foley work.
He reaches down and applies just a little bit of pressure to either bun, and it makes a noise like Denethor eating a tomato. Really gruesome. So he's just this pig, and he like tries to grope her thigh, and then "watch out," she says, because they hit this woman on the road who's a zombie, obviously, to us. The zombie picks itself up, dusts itself off while their back is turned, wanders off into the woods. The guy, meanwhile, is dropping probably half of this movie's F-bombs in just this scene alone. "Oh shit! Oh fuck! Oh
fucking
shit!
Shit.
Oh
fuck,
shit!
Fuck,
oh fuck!
Oh fuck! Where are we? What am I gonna? Oh fucking fuck!" Yeah. And meanwhile, the zombie wanders off, and they're like, "Well, I guess it was fine." Well, he's like that. She's still saying, "We gotta go find her. You know, we gotta take her to the cops." his dog hops down from the cab.
As soon as it's revealed that he has a Doberman, right? Is that the breed? I knew that, okay, that dog's not long for this world because zombie dogs are a staple creature.
Particularly that breed of zombie dog.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Hops down from the cab and laps up the bloodstain on the road.
The roadkill leavings.
And that starts the clock.
And it's really weird because she says, no, we got to go look for her. And he's like, you do what you want. I'm getting out of here. And then the next time we see them, they're like still together. So it's almost, I thought for sure that was a first act, like save the cat moment where she was going to just hoof it the rest of the way into town and leave this bozo, and then he would get mauled by his dog and she'd have dodged a bullet or something. But no, he drives her the rest of the way into town, so she doesn't get that moment. I mean, she does plenty to acquit herself later in the movie and show off her hero credentials. It was just a very strange introductory character beat. And then somewhere in all of this, there's a title drop that, as I said, is a little bit of a wet fart. It just happened. She's just like kind of standing in the road. There's a zoom in kind of would-be retro affect that Johannes does a lot, where it's just kind of zooming in on her from a distance, and they always look kind of sloppy and shitty with the way he does them, and then Resident Evil.
Yeah, so it says Resident Evil in big red block letters, and then there's like a road sign that says Welcome to Raccoon City, but it's not like centered in the frame, and it's
dark, rainy night,
and it's not particularly, I mean, it's easily readable, but it's like it's taking up about 12% of the screen. Like, it's clear enough to read, but it's not like this is the subtitle. It's just kind of there.
So then this guy wakes up in a hotel room somewhere. It looks to be a hotel room. This hard drinking cool dude, we think. We'll later learn that it's Leon Kennedy. And he wakes up with his alarm, kind of starts awake, and it's like he's in a morgue. The sheet is pulled all the way over his head like he's a Halloween boo gotcha ghost. Like it's fucking whistle and I'll come to you. And he pulls the blanket off and grabs a beer off his bedside desk, table, whatever, and swigs it and kind of winces and rubs his temple like he's got a hangover. And then I think, okay, this is going to be like this movie's Bullet or whatever, you know, B-U-L-L-I-T-T. But then he turns out to be just this kind of bumbling knob who doesn't do anything right. And he's a complete rookie who everyone else routinely shits on. The next time we see him, he's slumped over the bar at a diner. And the other cop characters are palling around in one of the booths. And this is where we get the incredibly ham-fisted character name drops.
Leave him alone, Wesker.
And, you know, they're ribbing each other. All of them. Jill.
Hey,
and
Valentine. Yeah, I bet you can't. Yeah, blah, 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 blah.
Well, it's like just he calls her Valentine. And then she grabs half of a sandwich, like a fucking hoagie or something, off of his plate, and then says, ah, that's a Jill sandwich now. And this is, of course, a cringe-inducing shout-out to one of the most cringe-inducing lines from the original Resident Evil, where you escape from a collapsing room, like a Temple of Doom-style, lowering ceiling, smushy like a pancake kind of trap room, and your colleague, I believe his name is Barry, goes, that was too close. You were almost a Jill sandwich. And so her saying Jill sandwich is bad enough, but at least if he hadn't called her Valentine half a minute prior, that would have been the, okay, this is Jill line. And it would have been, you know, it would have still been a little cringy, but it would have had some utility. Instead, it's just obnoxious.
You see, the Jill sandwich thing, again, having not played the games, over my head. Yeah. So.
Well, then you were also spared the next scene, which is Jill, who the same character, Barry, in the original game, calls Jill the master of unlocking. It's like a classic.
What?
It's just a translation issue, I'm sure.
Okay.
But, you know, there's a lot of weird syntax and just strange dialogue in that game, some of which has become Hall of Fame stuff in like games culture, for whatever that's worth. Jill shows up to her brother's house, picks the lock, lets herself in.
Wait, you mean Claire?
Yes, that's precisely what I meant. Claire shows up to her brother's house, picks the lock, lets herself in, and This is also very video gamey, but more modern than Resident Evil. She goes around, you know how in video games now when you're exploring like your own bedroom and you pick something up, it'll prompt the character to make some inane observation. It's usually pointing you in the right direction, like, I don't need a lamp right now. Like that kind of, that's how she talks to herself.
I'm already wearing a pair of socks.
Exactly. She's just picking up doodads off the shelf in this guy's house and puts on a football helmet. And then he comes downstairs and they have some sibling repartee and there's some hostility there. But mainly he just can't shut the fuck up about how good she is at unlocking doors. How did you do that? And, you know, honestly, just call her a master of unlocking at this point. You know, it's not going to be more eye roll inducing than the Jill sandwich thing from earlier. And the eye-rolling moments continue to accrue. I'm sorry, I
have to get this out of my brain. Having watched Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, as I do every year for Thanksgiving, just a few weeks ago.
A man of culture.
Right, exactly. That video game trope of, I don't need that right now, is reminding me of nothing so much as after they've lost a bunch of their credit, had them stolen. Like, they have no money, and they've got almost no credit cards. John Candy is saying, I have a card for this set of big and tall men's stores in the Pacific Northwest. Great stuff. Unfortunately, it does us no good here.
Oh, God. What's his name? Del?
Del Griffith.
He means well. We were sitting behind a pair of Del Griffiths in the movie theater today. Boy fucking howdy. If a pair of shower curtain ring salesmen, if ever I've seen them, they were just so sweet and so stupid. They were just having
so
the time
exhausting
of their lives. They were just simple, sweet creatures. More on that after the break, maybe.
Yeah.
So Claire talks about how she met this guy in a chat room who's like a whistleblower about
the
Umbrella.
Fuck's a chat room? Because yeah, this is 1998. You know, nerds don't know what chat rooms are, I guess.
Right. Or jocks.
Not non-nerds,
yeah,
excuse me.
Chads. Cops.
Fucking cops.
And Umbrella is the evil pharmaceutical company that's run Raccoon City into the ground and poisoned its population. And at first, this movie seems to have, like, a little bit of class war subtext. I mean, I think it does. It just gets kind of lost by the wayside very swiftly. But it made me wonder what, like, a Todd Haynes Resident Evil movie would look like. You know, like a Dark Water kind of thing. Because it seems
dark
to be...
Dark umbrellas.
Yeah, it seems to be laying that on pretty thick near the beginning, which is commendable enough, I guess. The guy that Claire met in this chat room, I guess, mailed her a VHS tape. This is the most brain scrambling moment of all the, like, this is the 90s moments. This one was the most head spinning.
It was particularly strange. She's loading it. I guess her brother has like a top loader VHS, like VCR.
Yeah.
It's been so long since I've named the piece of equipment. I couldn't even get the name out, but yeah, it's a top loading VCR. Like, that, you didn't see those in 1998. Even they were all front loaders by then.
Well, right.
It's just
and,
very weird.
And the poor actress is at cross purposes in this strange moment, because as she's loading the tape into the top of the VCR, she's turning to her brother and snarkily explaining what a chat room is. And so is she cutting edge, or is she putting VHS tapes in the mail? You know, which is it? It can't be both. She should have a floppy disk or something.
Yeah, but the flip side is, in 1998, how long would it have taken her to download a video?
Yeah, right. I'm trying to remember, like, downloading the first teaser for Phantom Menace, and it takes like half an hour. You know, that's
half an hour, yeah, more like half the day.
Yeah. So, and all of this is just so that we can meet, is it Jackie Earle Haley or some kind of, it's this.
I've never seen that guy before.
It's this,
he looks vaguely familiar, but I don't think he's anyone.
Well, he reminded me of Kevin Bacon's alter ego in You Should Have Left, who we likened to Jackie Earle Haley.
Right.
So that might be why I'm getting my wires crossed. He's just this squirrely kind of nebbishy, but like vaguely conspiratorial, Rorschach-y kind of guy with these chipmunk teeth. And these, like, kind of sunken cheeks.
Yeah.
And he has this... His performance is all tics. And it's just very mannered and kind of bad. And so all of this rigmarole with the VHS tape feels doubly useless. because it's just to get this mediocre monologue from him where he talks about, oh, umbrellas, you know, umbrella. And then he, you know, tells us stuff that we could have figured out on our own about how Umbrella had a Chernobyl-esque contamination situation, some kind of outbreak, some kind of disaster. Huh. And
it's interesting. Apparently the actor in question was in Anything for Jackson, which you said you watched, right?
Yeah. I think
plays a character named Ian. I don't know if that means anything to you.
No, the name means nothing to me. I think I know who he might have been.
I have not watched it, so I wouldn't know. Anyway.
Police station, right? We get Leon, who's the ostensible cool dude who spends the rest of the movie getting mercilessly ridiculed. Very strange character introduction for old Leon S. Kennedy, and very strange choice of where to take that character. More on that after the break. Rest assured, it's all of them in the police station. He's just a rookie. He's basically a receptionist. He's manning the front desk. In fact, the chief chews him out for trying to join the powwow,
the briefing,
the huddle, yeah, that everyone else is involved in. And the chief basically chews out anyone at the slightest provocation because he's a corny 90s movie commissioner. And he, speaking of corny 90s, he has this monologue where he's reading Wesker the Riot Act, because Wesker has just gotten a page that says something kind of cryptic and coded, you know, tonight's the night, check your locker, I think, words to that effect. And the chief's like, oh, what's the matter, Wesker? You got a hot date later? You gonna go to Planet Hollywood?
They got a great salad there. Or maybe you'll take her to your place, go rent a movie from Blockbuster.
Curl up on the couch and watch an episode of Ally McBeal.
Put on some Journey. Because you know how women react to Steve Perry's voice. Ain't that right, Valentine?
Only one of those was us riffing. All the rest of them,
yeah,
are
Ally
in
McBeal
the movie.
Was not a line. The rest, verbatim. Maybe not in the right order, but that's it.
If the goddamn Ally McBeal baby had danced into the room at that moment, it wouldn't have been any more facile. You know, I love the 90s.
The fucking dancing old man from Six Flags, yeah, could have showed up.
That could just be a T-virus mutation. It just turns you into that. Music and all.
The fuck is that music?
You've got like
from?
A Cronenbergian boombox just like jutting out of your shoulder blades. That's like half metal and half flesh. Like video
Long
drum.
Live the new flesh.
Yeah, you got it. So everyone but Kennedy is dispatched to the Spencer Mansion because some other officers were deployed there a little while ago and they went AWOL. Haven't heard back from them. So Kennedy's at the front desk. We're doing a lot of cross-cutting at this point. The truck driver has been bitten by his dog, and so he's
like
succumbing.
Almost the second after he dropped Claire off.
Which is why she should have just hoofed it the rest of the way into town, because it changes nothing and would have made her seem like that much more of a good guy. Because she's like, fuck you, man. I'm going to go tend to this person we hit. And then when she doesn't turn up anything, she has to walk to town through the rain. I don't know. That would have been like the Rambo thing to do, to be the drifter coming into town just under your own steam. You're not welded to this guy at the hip. Just like cut him loose. Anyway, his brains are rapidly turning into zombie porridge. And what else? We get introduced to a kind of sort of villain in the form of William Birkin, who's an Umbrella doctor, scientist. And
he was also the guy running the fucking
the orphanage.
Yes.
Although I didn't recognize him right away with that mop of hair that he's got on in the flashbacks.
He's got a really goofy wig on.
So we catch up with him and his wife and daughter. He seems reasonably doting. And then he gets a call. This is like right out of The Stand or something. And he's like, we got to go. And you think that they're booking it out of Raccoon City because he's just gotten wind of the fact that the place is going to be nuked from orbit, basically, or a magic portal's going to open up, one or the other, because one of them read from the Necronomicon or failed to check all the right boxes for the fucking cabin in the woods demon. But it turns out that they're actually speeding towards the facility where he works so that he can reclaim some vials, because it's my life's work. And for whatever reason, they live in a nice house. It looks like they probably have two cars, but for whatever reason, he brings his wife and daughter with him on this errand. he doesn't like pack them into a
the other car and send them out of town.
So then, and then he disappears for the rest of the movie until he's needed again, and then he and his family are pushed back on screen. I wish that the whole timeline of this movie is just very ill-judged. We got a lot of, as I said, cross-cutting. Eventually the movie settles into a rhythm, like once the cops make it to the mansion and once Claire
makes it to the police station.
Yeah, then we only have two places we're cutting back and forth between, and it still doesn't click. It just there's something about it that doesn't sync up quite right. In principle, cutting back and forth between two locations should be a boon, like suspense-wise, but the rhythm is just kind of flaccid, and we see way more of the police station than we get of the mansion, which is a mistake because the mansion is way more atmospheric and gloomy and gothic, and it's the location from the first game, so it's the one that more people are sentimental about, I'd wager.
Sure.
You know, I mean, the main draw of this movie for me was that it was going back to the source, and I was hoping to get a lot of Spook House, Spencer Mansion kind of stuff. I mean, that's my favorite thing about the GameCube remake of the first game, is that the environment is just immaculate. It's like beautiful to look at to this day. It's very 'twas a dark and stormy night. It's like wandering around in the House of Usher, you know. And this movie, just they get into the main hall, like the foyer or whatever, but that's at like the halfway point of the movie. It takes them fucking forever to get to the mansion and just get their foot in the door.
Yeah, takes a very long time.
And then once they're there, then it becomes like a 50-50 split, or maybe like 30-70 split between mansion and police station. But a bunch of the first half of the movie was also in the police station, so it's just incredibly lopsided. And the police station's from Resident Evil 2, which is also a classic game, but man, it can't compare.
Yeah.
We don't get any really good prolonged mansion sequences, which is what I was kind of hoping for. But you win some, you lose some, I guess. So the chopper crashes. Everyone's getting attacked by zombies. Everyone's kind of a little bit slow on the uptake because that's the way of zombie movies. You know, what happened to them? The belabored kind of realization.
Stop right there!
You need to shoot them in the head. And no one is slower on the uptake than Leon S. Kennedy. He is asleep behind his desk listening to some fucking dad rock needle drop on his headphones when the trucker from earlier...
No, this one isn't dad rock. It's that, like, Just a Little Crush. Like, I don't think the artist, she did anything else, but it's like a vaguely sexy, like, female vocalist pop song.
Yeah, no, you're right.
I only know this because it's burned on my brain because it's so dopey when...
Yes.
The truck flips over on its side, and it's a tanker truck, so of course it immediately explodes.
Of course.
And then zombie trucker eventually wanders in, and all we hear is this song.
Right.
And, like, it's probably supposed to be funny to a certain extent, but I was, like, laughing and also saying, no, really, fuck you.
Well, it's shades of Angel in the Morning from It Chapter 2. Yeah. Angel of the Morning, whatever, right. I said. But yeah, it's not quite that heinous, but it's a dud of the same flavor, a dud to the same degree. I just remember when the chopper crashes into the side of the mansion, the song that he's listening to is What's Going On by Four Non-Blondes, which is...
Well, that's before it crashes. It's when he's, like, hanging out in the forest waiting for them to get back when he gets attacked. Yeah, and he's playing that, like, snake game on his phone where you're, chasing the dot around.
Uh-huh.
Because it's the 90s, and that's the only phone game there was.
Right. Oh, Christ. It's a wonder that when the zombies rip him apart, a bunch of fucking pogs don't come pouring out of his pockets and sleeves. So now the rhythm, such as it is, I mean, I called it flaccid, which I think it is. The rhythm, such as it is established. Mansion, PD. And we meet the tinfoil hat, Jackie Earl Haley wannabe from earlier. And there's this scene in the basement of the police station. He's in like a lockup of some kind, a cell, and he gets eaten by his cellmate, and Leon is just bumbling and bungling his way through the entire movie. The women, I guess this is points for political correctness, and I don't even mean that completely facetiously. It's not that much of a plaudit, but it also doesn't make me angry particularly. The women in this movie are constantly coming to the men's rescue, which was a little bit nice to see, I guess, but it's a little thankless when at least one of the men in question is Leon, who can't tie his own shoelaces. So she's babysitting him the whole movie.
Let's be honest, he doesn't have shoelaces. He's got Velcro.
He's got Velcro.
Shoes.
Yeah, they light up on the heel. So the chief leaves in a huff, in a panic, really. And then there's this sub Iñárritu scene out in the city, or like Alfonso Cuarón or something, that's all shot from inside his car as he's getting hemmed
in. Wannabe Children of Men.
Yeah, he's getting hemmed in by traffic, and then there's a bunch of crossfire that shoots up his windshield. And the whole time, he's reacting like he got into a fender bender. Like, he's like, oh, shit, fuck, god damn.
Oh, man.
So then he comes back to the station, having accomplished nothing. They needed that scene for some reason. I guess it establishes that umbrella goons are, like, going through the city and exterminating people.
Well, and blocking the roads.
Yeah.
And he nearly gets attacked. Well, he gets attacked and nearly gets killed by the zombie Doberman before it gets its head smashed in by Claire with a fire extinguisher. So now it's the two of them and Leon hanging out in the police station.
Yeah. And the chief bizarrely knows that there's a tunnel connecting the orphanage to the Spencer Mansion.
Yeah, why would he know?
Well, so in Resident Evil 2, you spend the whole game in the police station, and at first it's just kind of funny and hokey in a video game way that there's all these hidden switches and revolving doors and shit. And the first game is set in an old spooky mansion. Home to a dead, wealthy eccentric. But in the police station, it doesn't make a lick of sense until you find out that there's like an umbrella laboratory in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
And then it makes a little bit more sense. So if he's in on the conspiracy, maybe that's like a callback to the game, but the movie never expands on that. And yeah, he dies the moment they get to the orphanage. He gets killed by the game's only licker, is the name of that monster breed. It's the one that looks like Carnage. I guess it was a shoe-in for this
movie.
Got
the exposed brain.
Yeah, right. The red kind of musculature and the long tongue and the sharp white teeth. Everyone's got fucking venom fever these days, apparently. So I guess a licker cameo was a foregone conclusion.
And then Lisa Trevor
never understand
showed
why those movies are making so much money.
I don't know.
Like a turd in the wind. That is a red one.
A line that inexplicably makes me chuckle, and it like makes me angry that I think it's funny, because there's nothing in that line that should be funny. I guess Tom Hardy is charismatic. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
And his Venom voice is just intrinsically amusing.
I can't fault you for that.
So it's the delivery, really. Anyway, so Lisa Trevor shows up and just wrecks the liquor, but mm-hmm. good. Basically pulls a like a garrote or a rag or something through
it. It's the manacles or whatever that are around her wrist. She's got these wooden, it's like she's a prisoner during, this whole movie. She just acts like Quasimodo. She's very gentle.
Yeah.
In the games, she's terrifying. Well, in the first game, more on that after the break. Anyway, she actually says that at one point. She doesn't sound quite so much like a Cookie Monster, but
yeah, kind of. There's a little there.
And she leads Claire, her BFF, and Leon, useless tumor, to the tunnel that leads to the Spencer Mansion. And that's the last we see of her, Lisa, that is.
Yeah.
So the two of them make it to the mansion. We finally catch up with Birkin. He is in his laboratory. Oh, and Wesker has had a heel turn by now, which we knew was coming. If you know anything about the games, Wesker is like the primary antagonist of many of the games. And so you know that he's going to be a turncoat sooner or later. But his heel turn is like needlessly confusing. I wound up liking it more than I thought I would, but it really muddies the water at first. In the games, near as I can remember, the fucking Yahoo sitting in front of me might correct me if they were here, because they were obviously a diehard fan. But I'm pretty sure he's just working for Umbrella in the games. And in the movie, he's working not for the cops, not for Umbrella, but for some third entity who wants dirt on Umbrella. And so he betrays the cops in order to get to the zombie juice in the basement, even though that goal doesn't necessarily clash with what the cops are there to do. It seems like his two roles could have been very compatible. He doesn't have to be such a Benedict Arnold about it.
Yeah, he's like, well, we got to go grab this thing. Yeah, I got some money in it. I'll give you some or whatever.
Right.
And then we can get the fuck out of here.
So instead of him being an outright villain, he's this tortured, like very conflicted anti-hero. And I hated that at first just because it was needlessly confusing and these games should be like Neanderthal simple. I mean, the games are not very, I mean, some of the arcane details of the lore are for fanboys only and escape me a little bit, but the broader points, you could explain them to a toddler. So I just, bringing in this, it's so stupid too, because what happens is Wesker confronts Birkin in the basement and Birkin's like, who do you work for? And Wesker says, does it matter? And Birkin says, I guess not. It seems like I felt the screenwriter's spirit leave his body at that point. It's like, it matters a little bit. You're just being fucking lazy.
I mean, never mind. Fair enough.
So what I can see it coming from a mile away. What they're setting up here is Birkin's transformation. And this is a riff on a cutscene from Resident Evil 2. Birkin is the main antagonist of Resident Evil 2. He's the nemesis of that game, basically. He shadows you. There's several boss fights. Every time you fight him, he's a little bit more of an abomination than he was the last time you saw him. Lisa Trevor functions similarly, although she doesn't transform quite as much. So in the game, Birkin is gunned down, I think just by a bunch of cops, or maybe...
Well, no, it's by Wesker.
Well, in the movie, in the game, he and his family, there's a hail of bullets, but it's like a bunch of just anonymous cops or Umbrella hired guns or something like that. And it's just to set him on the course to becoming this insane-looking monster. I love his design with the big, gross, blinking eyeball on his shoulder. In the game, it's better because he's just a big, kind of bloody pile of pixels, so you have to fill in the details with your imagination. You know, is that an eye? Is that a claw? What, you know, it's just kind of makes him... Well, so what happens is Wesker shoots him several times in the chest. Wife draws a gun on Wesker. Wesker shoots the wife. The whole time, he's got this sort of deer in the headlights look on his face, like this is spiraling out of control. And he doesn't shoot the daughter. The daughter, like, draws a gun on him. And then someone, there's a shot rings out, but it was it Jill?
It was Jill.
It was Jill. Jill has shot him from behind. He goes down.
This is the second time he got shot because Birkin also got a shot off.
Right. And then despite the fact that she hasn't seen him since his heel turn, and the first thing she saw him do after they were reunited was pull a gun on a 9-year-old. They have this tender moment where she's down on the ground with him as he's sputtering. And she's like, we're going to get you out of here. You're going to be okay. And meanwhile, Birkin has doped up with the nearest syringe full of T-virus or G-virus or whatever the hell.
I think that's what the vials said.
And he starts turning into a body horror monstrosity. And the design is fine. It's like it is in the game, only he just monologues incessantly, and that should not be the case. The virus should be burning down his brain like super rabies. You know, you shouldn't be fucking loquacious under those conditions. But there's this half-assed motif where, because he ran the orphanage, well, even Chris even says it at one point. He's like, William's the closest thing I have to a father. So there's this terrible, like, my boy, you know, it's like Birkin's tentacles are flopping around. Come to me, my lad, you know.
But he also says, you thought you could be part of my family? You're a fucking moron. That's
so bad. And I was so, spoilers, I guess, for my opinion, the standoff with Birkin and Wesker was the highlight of the movie for me. And if they had just pulled off the transformation, the movie would have generated a certain amount of goodwill for me in the end game. But once he starts fucking doing his villain spiel, all that goodwill swiftly evaporated. So somebody shoots Burke, and I think it's Jill first, and then Chris finishes him off. Not Jill, Claire, because everyone's reunited at this
point. Yeah, you know, back, the fuck, away, from my brother. You know, one of those.
Worst fucking tropes. That's what, like, children do that when they're playing in the front yard. You know, they don't say, back the fuck off, usually. But it'll be like, it just reeked of this kind of childish fan fiction-y kind of like, don't hurt my brother kind of thing. It's just juvenile. And yeah, it is every word, boom, every word is punctuated by another shot. It's a hacky. So Birkin looks like he's down for the count. All of them make it to train tracks under the facility, and they jump in the train, and they're hightailing it out of there. This is when the magic portal opens up underneath the mansion and swallows it whole. Then the train, there's like a blast of wind and dust and debris, and the train comes to a screeching halt. It's like askew on the tracks.
Yeah, it's derailed.
Yeah. Then Birkin comes back for round two, and he just looks and acts kind of boring. The only funny thing about it is that his human face, it's like
over one pec.
Yeah, right.
If the monster
he's
head
got like
pecs.
A pectoral face, and the face
goes
makes,
like...
but it's like so wimpy and defeated sounding. It's like he just, it's like he dropped his plate and like lost his scrambled eggs. It's like, oh man,
I got peanut butter on my penis.
So, and this is how I know the person sitting in front of us was just like a complete man-child fanboy. Leon Kennedy does his first worthwhile act in the entire movie and emerges from a different train compartment with a rocket launcher. And the person in front of us was just overjoyed that the rocket launcher made an appearance as though it were a beloved character. It's like the kind of Star Wars fan who cares about what color everyone's lightsaber is.
Yeah.
So Leon shoots the big baddie with a rocket launcher.
And Chris is like 2 feet away from the monster and is somehow fine.
Yeah, he's just hurled back by the explosion and not a scratch on him.
90s cheese, you know.
Yeah.
And
this is when we get the twister shot, incidentally. Again, it's way after the initial round of invisible shells start falling. It's, you know, we see explosions going off all over Raccoon City.
And then,
yeah, the cow gets it.
Yeah, then we get overlay green text of like, Umbrella Mission Report. Mansion destroyed. Nest labs and samples destroyed. Civilian survivors, 0. And then, of course, there are actually 5.
Yes, there's Birkin's daughter, and then our 4 heroes come staggering out of the tunnel.
Roll credits, then we get a mid-credit sequence where Wesker...
He wakes up in a body bag. It's actually a little bit reminiscent of the way Leon is introduced with like the shroud over him.
Right.
And he is just thrashing around and, you know, making those guttural noises, and he rolls off a gurney and like plomps on the floor out of frame. And I thought for sure it was going to cut just then and there. And it was a weird little slapstick beat to go out on. But we get, much like the diner scene, a very tortured character introduction. This sexy spy lady walks up, introduces herself. Why can't I see? What did you do to my eyes? You know, yeah, it's part of the bullshit. Matt has stopped listening. And then, she hands him a pair of sunglasses. And it's like the sunglasses are possessed. He puts them on and turns into the Terminator. He just instantly chills all the way out and gets this kind of stoic expression on his face.
Well, in the final shot, it's like depth of field, person in foreground, person in background, both in focus.
Uh-huh.
He's on the left, she's on the right. And in that shot, he looks like he's wearing the Deal With It GIF sunglasses. That's exactly what they look like.
And Wesker's sunglasses are an iconic part of his look, his presentation, and all the old games. But we don't need a fucking origin story for why he has to wear the sunglasses. I'm trying to think of what that reminds me of. It's like how Han Solo got his name. It's like, no one asked. No one wanted this.
Huh. And yeah, so the
and, woman, then, and then the, yeah, what's the, your name?
Ada Wong.
We know.
We
the people
know.
The people who know who the people who care already know, and the people who don't know won't care once they hear the name. It'll be meaningless to them. It'll be gibberish.
Oh yeah, cool name.
Yeah, that's a good name. All things considered, I like the way that sounds. Rolls off the tongue. More after the break.
Hello? What's your name?
What the hell happened here?
The Umbrella Corporation's been experimenting on this town since we were kids. People are getting sick. We have to stop Umbrella.
Show me your hands!
What the f-
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
The world needs to know what's really going on.
Resident Evil, Welcome to Raccoon City. Rated R. Exclusively in movie theaters November 24th.
And we're back. So, yeah, I mean, as I think we made clear during our rather extensive synopsis, there's not really a ton to recommend this movie. It's generally pretty dopey, and yet it's also broadly unobjectionable enough that I mind it a lot less than the absolute brain rot that is 47 meters down, or the just interminable nonsense that is Strangers Prey at Night, swimming pool scene notwithstanding.
Yeah. But 47 meters down made me feel like I was succumbing to the bends. You know, like you can't reemerge from the water too quickly because your blood will turn to nitroglycerin or something. I don't know how, it's something to do with your blood oxygen levels, but that whole movie is just so fucking tedious because everything has to happen in tiers like that. And every little setback, you realize sometimes watching like a certain kind of horror movie, like a wilderness survival kind of horror movie, a certain number of setbacks need to happen in order for the movie to be feature length.
Right.
And you know you're watching a bad movie of that ilk when every new setback just makes you go, come on. Even though, and not because you feel for the character and you're rooting for them and you don't want to see them come to harm, just because you want it to be over and done with. And it's weird because it's like, I knew this movie wasn't 20 minutes long when I put it on. Why am I angry? Why am I angry that it turns out this movie is 90 plus minutes? I knew that.
You're like, angry because it sucks.
Yeah, well, but right. That's the takeaway, is that you just wish that they would fucking figure it out so that the movie could turn into a surprise short.
Well, yeah, that and the twist at the end of that movie is like both unsurprising and insufferable. Just,
oh,
like,
where she just hallucinated.
Yeah, her sister's been dead the whole time. Uh-huh. Or, you know, it's like, fucking duh, of course. But also, why? You know. So anyway, the upshot of what I'm saying is, this is his best movie, but that is also damning with incredibly faint praise.
I mean, I like it more than either of the movies based on Doom. If this movie had come out in the early 2000s, which was a little bit of a heyday for video game movies, it would be one of the better ones. But you by see, 2021 standards, it's very poor.
I prefer Doom 2005 simply because I think it's got more goofy butt rock energy than this movie does.
That is a weakness of yours. Not like a moral weakness.
Sure.
I just mean, you know, we all it's have just, our guilty pleasures.
Right. Doom Annihilation is
Drek.
Just complete trash.
Yeah.
Like, if it hadn't had the name Doom attached to it, it's the sort of movie, if I had looked at a couple of screen caps, I would have been like, oh, this is a movie that I should never watch and, like, recommend only to my worst enemy. This is the movie that never gets taken off the shelf at Family Video. You know, rest in peace.
Yeah, Jesus.
Just like, sub B-movie garbage. It's just very bad.
So go see Welcome to Raccoon City, because it's a sterling addition to the pantheon of video game movie entertainments, but only when held to the standard of Doom Annihilation. I'm not, as I said, a Resident Evil purist. I don't care if they deviate from the games in this way or that. I think basically what they set out to do with this one is smush the first two games together. First game is set pretty much entirely in the Spencer Mansion and the grounds. Second game is spent pretty much entirely in the police precinct area, and they're very self-contained, and they are more or less contemporaneous. The first game you play as Jill Valentine and or Chris Redfield. Second game you play as Claire Redfield and or Leon Kennedy. And here the gang's all here, and that creates some difficulties, I think, because the characters in the game are just all cool dudes, you know, and that's right. That's fine when the casts are less congested, because Jill and Chris are not in Resident Evil 2. So when we meet Leon and Claire, it's okay that they're also just cool, really capable cool action heroes, because the two cool, capable action heroes from the last game aren't around to make them redundant. But when all four of them are sharing the screen together, or just, you know, sharing the same movie, you need to diversify a little bit. And so they just made Leon
a doofus,
the comic relief. But he's not even comic relief. It's like if Jar Jar Binks just sounded like a guy. It's like if Jar Jar Binks just was and sounded like a dude, but was equally inept. It's the damnedest thing. I don't know. And, you know, it wouldn't have made any more sense to do it with Chris or certainly either of the main women. If you have to make one of them into a buffoon, I guess do it with Leon, because, but I don't know. It'd be like, I don't know. You can have a movie that's full of cool characters, and they're all just cool in different ways that complement one another. It's like if Jason Momoa was slipping on banana peels in Dune. You know, it's like, that's not necessary. He and Josh Brolin can both be cool. what's the big deal? That was an extremely bizarre decision, and he's kind of got an arc, Leon, where he becomes cooler and more capable and finds himself and gets the rocket launcher.
Woo-hoo! Clap, 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 clap.
Yeah, clapping like a fucking circus seal. God, I wish I was that happy. I wish anything made me that happy.
Just spent the entire movie just wildly gesticulating, mostly silently, fortunately, but it was still profoundly distracting from the row immediately in front of us.
Yeah, well, and they would, you know, if something annoying happened, there'd be like a face palm, or, you know, the hands would go up over the head, and I don't know, sweet, simple Del Griffiths, like I said before. God bless him.
Just fanboying us to death.
Mm-hmm. So what they did with Leon passes understanding. What they did with Lisa, I'm equally annoyed by. In the game, the first game, actually the remake of the first game, which is my favorite in the series, the GameCube remake of Resident Evil 1, Lisa is terrifying. Probably the scariest encounter in the game, unless you're me, in which case the spiders win by a country mile, but that's just by virtue of the fact that they're big photorealistic tarantulas. Lisa Trevor is just, you know, just tragic and anguished and makes this terrible noise. You hear her before you ever lay eyes on her. You just hear this pained wailing, like, but echoing as out of some chasm. It's like an elevator shaft, I think, is the first time that you trigger that noise. But she lives in the walls and in warrens under the mansion. So you're always worried about bumping into her, and you really don't see that much of her. It's not like the Nemesis system, where she can actually get the drop on you at any moment. I mean, it's much more scripted than that. But nonetheless, the game, you know, I guess at least by video game standards, does a good job of humanizing Lisa Trevor without defanging her. I mean, she's not like a super deep character or anything, but she's tortured, and not in the movie Wesker, like, oh, fuck, I'm at cross purposes sense. Right. I'm mildly conflicted, but like she is in like agony and can no longer recognize friend from foe and is just lashing out and ending the life of whatever crosses her path. And so you feel sorry for her, but it's
she gotta go.
Yeah, well, and just, you gotta turn tail and run. You're not gonna like tame the beast, you know. Right. Most of those encounters you can't do anything to harm her, and then I think the final confrontation you get the better of her somehow. The particulars escape me, but they're not really important. Anyway, in the movie she's just this cuddly homunculus who's only ever seen doing kind of tender-hearted things or coming to the rescue. Another instance of a woman coming to the rescue, actually.
Right.
And that I just didn't. If Claire had come out of this traumatic childhood fearing this boogeyman creature that she remembered from the orphanage, that her brother always told her was just in her imagination, and then she goes back to the orphanage as an adult, and there's scurrying and creaking and shadows, and she has an encounter with Lisa Trevor. The framework is there. The narrative setup is there for Lisa to have this kind of mythic child's worst fear kind of stature. But instead, she's just, I don't know, like Pete's dragon, basically.
Well, yeah, Claire should have to learn that Lisa can be helpful.
Right.
It should not occur to her immediately.
Right. And ideally, it should take the form of Lisa coming to her rescue and like saving them from a monster. But rather than just a licker putting in a thankless cameo appearance, maybe it could have been like Birkin at the very end. Would have been better than the dumb rocket launcher explosion.
Well, not for our fellow movie.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. Although, you know, I like to think that a Lisa Trevor Birkin showdown would have been, that's like a fan fiction wet dream.
I don't know. This person was very keen on the rocket launcher.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, after the credits rolled,
they were still talking about it.
Well, these two people turned around in their seats to like engage us in conversation.
Well, and even before the movie started, no, it was like during the first scene. It was like after the movie began, but before they stopped chattering, which they mercifully did stop for the most part.
Offered us their spare popcorn.
Yes, which, you know, lady, I'm wearing a mask. You know? Like, I'm not gonna take down, read the room, no thank you. But that's what cements the Planes, Trains, and Automobiles-ness of it all. That's what makes them such John Candies, is that they would, you know, oh, eyes bigger than my stomach, turn around and offer me 80% of a large bucket of popcorn.
Lady, maybe, with all of their COVID on it.
Yeah, right, exactly. Maybe under different circumstances, I would have taken you up on that, and we would have been fast friends, and I would listen to your podcast.
But, yeah, they turned around their seats, and the really fanboyish one, because it was like mother and child, like grown adult, yes, child, but still. And the fanboy one is explaining, oh, well, there's this part in the game where if you use the rocket launcher at this particular time and blah, 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 and I was really hoping for that. And so I was just really glad that the rocket launcher showed up eventually. Like, good.
All right.
Cool. I'm happy for you. We're going to go.
It's like, are you here from Ain't It Cool News or from Game Facts? It's like your Game Facts fucking in-house movie critic. Seeing, you know, whether Welcome to Raccoon City adheres to a beat for beat, level by level breakdown of the original game's contents.
Just like strange. The shittiest subreddit.
Yeah, right. So I don't like what they did with Leon. I don't like what they did with Lisa. And, you know, again, not a Resident Evil purist. I also just don't think it makes for good entertainment that Leon is constantly tripping over his own Velcro laces and Lisa is just Barney the dinosaur. There's just nothing to that. Now, a change that I did like, and which I was expecting to be very sour on, it's the only thing that kind of in my mind justifies Wesker's heel turn being as weird as it is, because he can't be an umbrella stooge if he's being used as the stand-in for the cops that shot William Birkin. So roping the two of them into that standoff, the way it played out and the look on Wesker's face as he like got deeper into the shit and was like, what have I become? That kind of thing. And, you know, Wesker up till this point, it's not like he has incredible acting chops. Like everyone else in the movie, he's just kind of some hunk. But like that moment was rather well played, I thought. And I don't know if I'm just completely off the mark here, but I kind of woke up a little bit during that whole stretch up to the beginning of the Birkin transformation, and I thought, okay, all right, the movie's starting to win me over a little bit, because this was an almost like like a retcon, but it's like a what if parallel universe kind of Resident Evil fanfic sort of thing. Like, right, what if Wesker had been the one to shoot Birkin? It'd be like, okay, what if Mary Jane had died instead of Gwen Stacy? And it's like one of those kind of fucking things that like comic nerds cream themselves over. And I was not creaming myself, but I was kind of enjoying the unexpectedness of it, and just the, I can't stress this enough, the very moderate pathos that it generated, the minimal drama generated by this sort of staggered Mexican standoff where Birkin shoots Wesker and Wesker shoots Birkin. Mrs. Birkin shoots Wesker. Wesker shoots Mrs. Birkin. And then baby Birkin pulls the gun on Wesker. And it just, like, it was, like, kind of sloppy. But, I mean, in Johannes's movies are always a little bit sloppy. But here it seemed like, I don't know. I actually felt for Wesker slightly in that moment. And that moment would not have worked if he was just an out-and-out abject son of a bitch the way he is in the video game. So I understood why they spun that the way they did. And it was the only moment in the movie where I felt anything at all. And sometimes I don't want to get too carried away, you know, extolling it, because it can be damning with faint praise after a certain point. You know, there are movies that you watch that make you feel so numb that when anything to your liking happens, you go like, yeah. I had, you know, this is my most embarrassing confession in the history of this podcast, and you can maybe verify this if you remember it. The moment in my movie-going life when I was the most like the John Candy sitting in front of us was for some fucking reason in Star Trek Into Darkness, when Khan, like, comes back unexpectedly near the end. It looks like the movie's ending, and then fucking Benedict Cumberbatch comes out of nowhere, and I was like, yeah. I like actually fist pumped because I was catatonic. I was like, fuck yeah, like the movie's, you know. And I don't know what came over me. I was like, instantly I felt like, what the fuck, why did Star Trek Into Darkness do that to me? And I think it's because I was just kind of in a stupor, and something similar was playing out in my being, in my person, watching the beginning of the Birkin death transformation thing. Now, once he starts monologuing, poof, gone. I was back into my kind of numbness and my hibernation. I was back underground watching Resident Evil Welcome to Raccoon City as if from a very great distance, not engaging with it at all.
The only moment of Star Trek Into Darkness that I took special pleasure in is when Simon Pegg says,
"Oh,
the
yeah.
door is very wee."
Yeah, that was rather good. I liked the music. The music had gravitas all through this movie. It was a little bit of that 80s inflected thing that I'm tired of with the synths and such, but there was some like choir work in it that sounded kind of echoey and distorted. It didn't really make me think of Resident Evil per se, but it sounded a little bit epic and kind of momentous and better than the movie deserved, and like the kind of thing that I could theoretically find myself listening to, you know, if I'm like trying to write something with a horror bent and I just want some like background noise on. And I'm predicting that you could put on some of the tracks from this score and your mind would not be awash in images from Resident Evil Welcome to Raccoon City, because there are no indelible images in Welcome to Raccoon City, because Johannes Roberts mostly doesn't seem to have indelible images in him.
Now that I think about it, there was one sequence that I kind of liked visually.
Was it the blackout?
The blackout.
Yeah. It went on a little long, but I liked it.
Yeah, they did drag it out a little bit, but yeah. In the mansion, it's blacked out, and Chris is by himself in a room that keeps running into zombies, and he has to shoot them. And so it's just like black muzzle flash, black muzzle flash. And it, as Matt said, it runs on probably at least 50% too long.
Mm-hmm.
But in and of itself, it's cool.
No, and the way it's cut together is rather nice. And we're talking pitch black, you know. And,
right.
And so it's just kind of this storm of snarling zombie faces and thrashing limbs. And it is just cool looking. I mean, it's probably the most like butt rock moment in the whole movie. if you'd put some like under it would have been a match made in heaven.
Right.
Yeah, no, that sequence was pretty decent. Pretty decent.
So, in terms of recommendations, I'm just going to take the easy way out and recommend the first three Paul W.S. Anderson Resident Evil movies. As I've said, and I know this even though I haven't played the games, they do not correspond really at all to the stories from the games. There's a little bit of overlap. I think the second one has Nemesis as the antagonist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Stars.
And Jill Valentine appears in that one. But other than that, it's basically just fanfic, uh-huh. as we've said. And they're not intelligent movies, but they're fun. They're fun. And I don't really have anything more to say about them. You know, go in with managed expectations, and you will come out having had, I think, a fairly good time. And even the fourth one is kind of fun. Fifth one is not very good, and the sixth one is absolute trash. It's edited like the editor had, I don't know, schizophrenia and Tourette's syndrome or something simultaneously. It just gives me a fucking headache. But yeah, I'm going with the first three of the Mila Jovovich films.
I gotta get on that. I think the blackout sequence that you just rightly praised reminded me, in terms of its freneticism, a little bit of some of the standout sequences from Dog Soldiers.
Oh, sure.
A werewolf movie that I rather like. Neil Marshall, is that right? Director of The Descent. Two excellent horror movies from the early to mid-aughts. Dog Soldiers it has the same kind of... I was thinking of Aliens in my mind's eye, the James Cameron movie, as you were describing, like, the muzzle flares and, you know, him just being swarmed. Or I think it was my own imitation of the, like... because of the fucking plasma guns or the plasma rifles or whatever they're called in Aliens always have that kind of sporadic, almost rhythmic, like, firing sound.
Right.
You never get, like, a steady stream of fire in that movie. It's always... And that makes it more exciting somehow, just because it doesn't get... You don't ever have time to get used to it, I guess. There's enough dead air to keep it kind of impactful. Dog Soldiers has some of the same energy and kind of, like, kinetic action, horror, chutzpah of Aliens, which is very high praise indeed. And then Welcome to Raccoon City has a very scant amount of that to offer, but not none. Just that one scene, really.
Sure.
So Dog Soldiers is worth checking out. I also heartily recommend Resident Evil for the GameCube, which is the one that debuts Lisa Trevor, actually, and the one that it's still, you know, if you tell me, if you say the words Spencer Mansion to me, that's what I picture. It's just one of my favorite video game environs, and I could wander around those spooky hallways accomplishing nothing and just give myself goosebumps and not even make progress in the game, just kind of enjoy being in that space. It's wacky because it's Resident Evil. There's even a line in this movie where Jill, I think, just making small talk, is like, what would be worse, to be eaten by a giant snake or a giant great white shark? And wouldn't you know it, those are both boss fights from Resident Evil. Because for some reason, this serum that turns people into zombies also just makes animals big. But it's not like a zombie shark, it's just a big shark. So it's harebrained, but there's something incongruously classy about that GameCube remake of the first Resident Evil. It's got the polish and the production value. Substantively, it's like a Saturday morning cartoon. It's like if like a G.I. Joe episode were done in the style of Silent Hill. It's really bizarre, but you find yourself going along with it. You're alone for so much of that game. The corny bits are always when you're interacting with other people, whenever anyone has to open their mouth, basically.
Sure.
But you're alone with your own thoughts for so much, just listening to the wind and various other atmospherics, that it becomes much easier to buy into the stupid fiction of what's happening. You don't know what's going to be around the next corner, and eventually you just kind of stop questioning it. But games can do that, I think, better than movies, just by virtue of being much longer, and you have more time to acclimate to the nonsense.
Well, and there's just a certain amount of immediacy that forces you to confront it on its own terms.
Right, well, it's just like no one's... Well, that too, it's kill or be killed, whereas right. In a movie, you're just kind of from a distance.
Fuck you!
Yeah, right. But yeah, it's a personal fave, and this movie doesn't even come close to doing it justice. I wish that more of it had been set in the Spencer Mansion. I was saying before we started recording, maybe part of the reason that we don't get very much Spencer Mansion in this movie, despite the fact that it feels like two roads diverging in a wood, and it's going to be a 50-50 split, this kind of bifurcated approach where it's half mansion and half police station, it really isn't. And I wonder if it's because there wasn't actually that much mansion. When we reviewed Winchester, I pointed this out. That whole movie is like 2.5 rooms. and one kind of weird-looking staircase. It doesn't feel like a haunted...
Slightly odd.
It doesn't feel like a haunted mansion so much as a haunted mobile home.
Yeah, and not just a haunted mansion, but a haunted M.C. Escher mansion.
Uh-huh.
Is what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, right, exactly. And you just get no sense of that non-Euclidean geometry. There's not even any normal geometry, because the rooms, don't feel connected to one another at all. And the Spencer Mansion, it's not that bad, but it does feel just scanty and insubstantial. And I wonder if it's because they just didn't want to build enough set. Yeah, right. I mean, who knows these days how much is actual timber and how much is done in post. But whatever the case may be, not enough mansion for my money.
Well, with that, I think we'll leave Raccoon City behind to be...
Yes, farewell to Raccoon City.
Demolished by Umbrella's bombs.
Subterranean or otherwise.
Farewell, cow. So until next time.
First shot of the next Resident Evil should be that cow flying into frame.
Very good.
Having been Jan DeBonted out of frame in the last movie. Jan DeBont.
Until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Girondese, the master of podcasting.
We're the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Resident Evil Welcome to Raccoon City Nightmare Trailer HD in theaters November 24th, uploaded by Sony Pictures Entertainment. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, January 2nd, and we will be discussing Guillermo del Toro's noir-inflected new release, Nightmare Alley. See you then.